Hi, I'm Aurelius.
And I'm Garrett.
And this is Home Team. In this episode, we discuss the book Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition by Cedric Robinson, and play a micro game called Robinson Said. So yeah, very excited to hop into this discussion with you, Garrett, about this book, which to me is, hot take, don't come for me, in my opinion, the most important book in this entire reading group. It was a book that I first heard about during the summer of 2020, when a lot of reading suggestion lists were coming out in the aftermath of the police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others. But I didn't get to read it until I went to my master's program in Chicago in 2021. And it's just such a brilliant book. There's a lot in it. It is a thick one. So hopefully in this podcast, we can help to break down some of the main points. I will say, just as a very brief overview, Cedric Robinson is making several arguments, but one of the main arguments within this book is that Karl Marx and Marxism in general did not do enough to contend with race and racial categories in their explanatory power of how the world works and how capitalism works specifically. And though Cedric Robinson is not like the originator of racial capitalism, within this book, he takes racial capitalism a lot further than it had been taken before this book was published, to really get into the ways that racialism and racial categories do a whole lot of work to create groups of people who can be exploited into classes that are necessary for capitalism to exist. And this book is also conceptualizing and theorizing around a Black radical tradition. And so Cedric Robinson is arguing that Black radicalism and African radicalism, people who are descended from Africa, their resistance, their writings, their activism, have a whole lot to inform us and tell us about resisting capitalism through an Afrocentric lens. And so he's looking at three main characters to make that argument, some of which you all have heard, hopefully by listening to our podcast. We've mentioned Black Reconstruction and W.E.B. Du Bois quite a lot on this podcast. Big fans. Hopefully you've heard of Du Bois in other contexts as well. That is one of the main figures that he is stating is a clear example of practicing this Black radical tradition. The second one being C.L.R. James, who is one of the authors who we read earlier in this reading group, his book, The Black Jacobins. And then you also have Richard Wright, who is a very famous Black author, who also is dealing with and contesting with sort of his Blackness, his racial analysis and his class analysis, and joining the Communist Party and seeing some limitations within sort of class analysis alongside the racial analysis, which again, Cedric Robinson is making the argument that like you can't have one without the other, that to understand capitalism, you have to understand racialism, you have to understand race. And so that is a very short overview. We will get into more of the main topics and takeaways within this book. But I want to pass it over to you, Garrett, to give an overview of the author, Cedric Robinson himself.
So I'll also start by saying this is my favorite book out of all the books that we're reading on in this group. It's probably my favorite book period that I've ever read, at least certainly nonfiction. And I think, you know, listeners, people will sort of see why as we sort of break down all the details of this book. So I'm going to give some background on Cedric Robinson, who he is, where he grew up, the sort of context in which he wrote the book. So I'm going to try to focus most of this on like around the time period he's writing the book, but I'll talk a little bit about his like upbringing as well. So he was born in Oakland in California in 1940. So his family was one of many families who migrated from the Deep South to the West Coast, specifically California, during the 1940s. It's like the second wave of the Great Migration. Where a lot of Black people migrated from the Deep South, especially to places like Chicago from around like World War One, like into the 1920s. That migration continued in the 30s and 40s. And in that little slightly later period, more and more people were migrating west. So Robinson grew up in California. He was involved in campus activism at UC Berkeley in the early 1960s. Couple examples of this are he was in the NAACP chapter at UC Berkeley, and they invited Robert F. Williams to an event, to speak at an event at UC Berkeley. For those who don't know, Robert F. Williams is a very militant Black activist from North Carolina during the early 1960s. He's most famous for and well known for his positions on armed self-defense. So he's a big advocate of armed self-defense during a period in which some other Black activists were not quite pushing for armed self-defense as much as he was, at least at the national level. And he's also a big advocate of like internationalist politics. So Robert F. Williams supported the Cuban Revolution, other Third World revolutions, African decolonization. So Robinson interacted with him. He also invited Malcolm X to speak. So he's really like, you know, in the thick of what's going on in the 60s. And Robinson spent some time in Africa in the 1960s while he was a student. He spent some time in Mexico. And this is really important because it helps him to sort of gain an understanding of like the culture and politics of both Mexican and African people. It's particularly important in the case of Africa. So this is when he sort of starts to form some of the ideas that you later see in Black Marxism around the African roots of Black radicalism. So moving into the 1970s real quick, Robinson gets a PhD in political science. So he does a lot of work with political theory. And he published a book, The Terms of Order, Political Science and the Myth of Leadership. So this book is basically taking on the discipline of political science and its assumptions. And he's arguing against the idea that people like need leaders to lead them. Like he's arguing against the idea that they need figureheads in politics. And this sort of comes out of his experiences in Africa, because he sees that like these people don't have like hierarchical leadership structures in the same way that like a lot of Western societies do. So that book is important because it's like an early example of Robinson's really critiquing Western ideas. And that's something he does throughout his career and does in Black Marxism. So moving on to around the time he published the book. So in the 1970s, in the mid-1970s in particular, there's these debates that are usually amongst like Black leftists that are usually referred to as like the nationalist versus Marxist debates. They really take hold in 1974 and 1975. And basically what these debates are, it's a series of very intense and often very personal disagreements between Black activists such as Amiri Baraka and some Black nationalists as well, about like what's really at the root of Black people's oppression. Is it race or is it class? So these two camps take like diametrically opposed positions. So like one group's like, it's all race, you know, Baraka, some other people are like, no, it's all class. Ironically, Baraka himself was a nationalist, but he sort of shifted towards Marxism at this period. So there's these big debates going on. You also see them in Africa as well. In Tanzania, there's like radical thinkers like Walter Rodney who are saying like, hey, decolonization is not working the way it's supposed to in Tanzania, because, which is an East African country, because the sort of ruling class is like doing things for its benefit. Whereas like the leader of the country is sort of saying like, no, it's about nationalism. It's not about class. So like this is a big debate going on. And it's important because Robinson's book sort of comes on the back end of this and is really trying to like present a more sophisticated perspective about like race and class.
Right.
So his sort of claims about Marxism in the book, which we'll talk about in a bit, are really rooted in a deeper understanding of Marxism. He's showing the limits of Marxism, and he's showing how you can use dialectics, you know, like as a method to deconstruct Marxism, to break it down, and to also understand the way that race factors into the making of the modern world. And last, but certainly not least, while he was working on this book, Robinson was at Binghamton University, which is in upstate New York. It's a relatively small university, but its claim to fame is that a type of analysis called world systems analysis, which is really about the sort of rise of capitalism in the modern world, sort of originated at Binghamton. And it's like sociological theory. So he sort of draws on that as he writes this book. And we'll talk a little bit about that, because like the early chapters are very much about the rise of capitalism. So those contexts, you know, the three things: Robinson's sort of involved in African decolonization, involved in black politics. He's sort of thinking about this in the context of these nationalist Marxist debates. And then he's also in like an academic space that is, you know, thinking about things like the rise of capitalism, I think are important background for the writing of the book.
Yeah. And I feel like crucially to the writing of this book, the reading of this book, and engaging with Robinson's work is to understand like his close involvement with struggles of this time, right? And that, again, like we've seen with several of the authors in this reading group, it's not simply or solely an academic endeavor for them, right? It is also one that, like, the answering of these questions is crucial to the struggle of the time, but also for their own sort of understanding of how the world works and how they can engage in it through their activism. The book is broken up into three main parts. Part one is the emergence and limitations of European radicalism. Part two is the roots of Black radicalism. And part three is Black radicalism and Marxist theory. And so each of these parts have several chapters. We're not going to go into detail of each chapter, but we do want to break down some of the key concepts and theoretical backings for each of these parts. And so in part one, the emergence and limitations of European radicalism, Robinson is doing a lot of work to look at the makings of capitalism and also European civilization. And is thinking about what are the limits of how Marxism has analyzed class struggle and the world, specifically in like a European context. And so I don't want to continue without like us talking about what is Marxism and like what Cedric Robinson is doing, how he is understanding Marxism and how he is criticizing Marx and Lenin's and others' ideas around class and capitalism. So Garrett, could you give us like a brief synopsis of like what Marxism is, what its main arguments are, and then how Robinson is contesting with it?
Yeah, of course. So we've talked about this a little bit previous episodes. This came up in the Black Jacobins episode a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. But Marxism, like most simply, it's a philosophy, and it describes, analyzes, you know, critiques history and society, and it does so in a few different ways and through a few different methods. So it's focused on critiquing and understanding capitalism. It's focused on understanding class struggle, and then it uses two sort of main methods to do that: historical materialism, which is the idea that history develops based on like modes of production and based on the sort of material conditions of society, and then dialectics, which is a method that just says change happens through the development of like opposing and contradictory forces. So the reason why this is important for Robinson is that the time in which he's writing, and even up till today in some cases, most people's understandings of political radicalism are like very much they come out of Marxism or out of the like Marxist tradition. And he is, in the first section of the book, you know, he takes what Marx and Marxists after him have sort of understood as like the origins of capitalism, and he breaks it down and he shows the limits of their analysis. So a couple of the ways he does that is he critiques historical materialism. So historical materialism, again, it's focused on the ways in which like modes of production sort of drive the development of society. And he says that this way of looking at history, which was Marx's way of looking at history and the way that a lot of Marxists since then have looked at history, he's saying it doesn't take enough account of race, the role of race in shaping the modern world. So he's saying like Marxism as a theory, like as a body of ideas, like has these limits. And one of them is it sort of creates a framework that can't really grapple with race in the way that it ought to be grappled with. So in order to correct that, Robinson, you know, takes Marx's discussion of the rise of capitalism and he looks at similar time periods and similar developments, but he says, how is race factoring into this as well? So he says like race and racism existed before capitalism. So when capitalism emerges, like racial ideology doesn't just disappear. It's still a factor in how people go about engaging in the economy and how capitalism expands. And then he says that the English working class, which is Marx's famous sort of subject for the rise of capitalism, he says, well, they're also affected by race as well. And they're right. affected by race because they see Irish people as like a racialized population that are like, quote unquote, lesser than them. So that's really the core of Robinson's critique of Marxism, is that he thinks historical materialism doesn't take enough account of race. And the second part of his critique of Marxism is that he thinks that Marxism and Marx's understanding of history, which is usually like moves along in stages where there's like sort of clean breaks between like one era and the next, he was saying that that doesn't allow us to sort of see how there's like continuations from like feudalism into capitalism. And one such continuation is the presence of racism. So he's saying that this understanding of history, this understanding of the material world as the driving force of societies is limited. And I think to sort of bring back a point from earlier, it's important to think of this also in the context of those nationalist versus Marxist debates, because a lot of these black activists in like 74, 75, such as Amiri Baraka, Abdullah Kalamat, they adopted a very crude version of Marxism. So he is like sort of in that context, looking at Marxism a bit more critically than they did in like 74 and 75. And sort of showing the limits of it as a theory. And that first section is where he really does that.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, like most crucially, like my main takeaway from this and like in conversations that I have with people around unionizing and like labor struggles of today and like the continued need to have a racial analysis around society and the world that we're organizing around is this really detailed exemplification that Cedric Robinson is making within this book around the Irish and their colonization and the ways that like that violent act was racialized, right? Like the Irish were being racialized to be made inferior and subjugated and to rationalize and justify the actions of the colonization by England, right? And so that's really huge to think about for like people who are descended from Europe, as well as for like this criticism generally of Marxism and of just like the limits, I believe, of only looking at Western civilization, and particularly like Eurocentric modes of analyzing the world. And I think Robinson is doing a lot to criticize Marxism and also like add to the canon of Marxist theory and thought by bringing in this racial analysis as like not just additive or like not only becoming a thing when you bring in African peoples and black people, right? But that like no race and racialization is a phenomenon that predates capitalism and it's still is a major, major player, if not the major player, the major factor into the reasons why capitalism continues to wreak havoc on civilizations and populations. There's this quote I want to read from this first part on emergence and limitations of European radicalism. It's on page 66 in the third edition, which I think just gets to a really good criticism and gets to sort of like summarizing what Robinson is arguing here. He says, the limits of Western radicalism as demonstrated in Marxist theory, the most sustained critique of the modern era, are endemic to Western civilization. Those limitations relate directly to the quote-unquote understanding of consciousness, and the persistence of racialism in Western thought was of primary importance. It would have been exceedingly difficult and most unlikely that such a civilization in its ascendancy as significant power in the world would produce a tradition of self-examination sufficiently critical to expose one of its most profound terms of order. Racialism, as I have tried to show, ran deep in the bowels of Western culture, negating its varying social relations of production and distorting their inherent contradictions. The comprehension of the particular configuration of racist ideology in Western culture has to be pursued historically through successive eras of violent domination and social extraction that directly involved European peoples during the better part of two millennia. And I think this quote really gets at the heart of this argument of like Western civilization isn't without its racism, you know, that like Marxism should have and needs to, moving forward, like after the publishing of this book, take into account racist ideologies and like racial categorizations as fundamental to critiques of capitalism.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that sort of the way that he shows that race is like internal to European society, it's not something that exists only when you see Europeans interact with Africans. I think, you know, that also does a lot to dispel myths, like of myths around African people, racist myths around African people, because when you see race as something that only existed when Europeans interacted with Africans, you're more liable to sort of say like, oh, so like there was something like distinctly different about like these African people that like, you know, meant that's why they, you know, were put into some subjugated position. But he shows like, no, there's this idea of racial subjugation that has existed in European society, and that European society exported when it began to sort of expand like into the New World. And of course, a big part of that expansion is the slave trade. And another point I think that is important in the first part is that, you know, he shows race is internal, and then he also shows that as, you know, some Marxists would like to think that, you know, Europe was not like he says not a closed system. So like Europe didn't exist. And it's, you know, it's trade, it's interactions, the rise of capitalism didn't exist outside of its relationships with Africa and the New World. And this is an argument that, you know, by the time he made this argument, black scholars had made for a while, you know, but it had long been not taken very seriously by Marxists as well as just other white scholars or Western scholars. So he's able to use those two arguments to show that race is exported and that the creation of capitalism involved the, you know, connections between various societies inside and outside of Europe. So it wasn't that people were pulled into capitalism and then were sort of unable to sort of like quote unquote catch up, which is like an argument that you see made about why, you know, places in Africa are like supposedly quote unquote like not developed, you know, it's a word that people like to use.
Right.
But he shows how the development of European capitalism was contingent on the underdevelopment, like a word that Walter Rodney uses and other scholars use, on the sort of the pillaging of African society and the violence of the slave trade.
And I also want to bring in the foreword to the third edition, which is written by Robin D.G. Kelly, who's one of my favorite historians, public intellectuals, because it is being written in 2020, and it is contextualizing the uprisings in response to, again, police murders of Black people in the United States, as also being, or I guess carrying the torch of this Black radical tradition, and very much like deeply embedded with this Black radical tradition, and showing how very popular movements like the Movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter were using Cedric Robinson's language and text and like analysis for our activism during this time, right? Like you saw critiques of policing being connected to critiques of racial capitalism. You saw the Black radical tradition being used as like a mantle, as a calling card to like the organizing and work that we were doing in 2020. And that's, I think Robin Kelly is making the argument like that that is a clear testament to Robinson's like power and like the importance of his work and of this book specifically, and also to show like how these theories, these concepts, these ideas within this book are still super, super relevant in modern times and in 2020 specifically. So let's move on to like this concept of racial capitalism. I think in this foreword, Robin Kelly is talking a lot about reckoning with racial capitalism. He says, Cedric revealed exactly how racial capitalism, quote, creates the difference between classes and why anti-racism is fundamental to combat the difference. And so I hope like as people who have listened to different episodes of the podcast are beginning to connect the dots of all of these books that we've read within the Black radical tradition, and this being the book that is like conceiving of this track of the reading group, the Black radical tradition, and seeing how the book that we read, the second book, I believe, What is Anti-Racism and Why It Means Anti-Capitalism, is so deeply connected to this book, right? And how race and racism are creating the conditions for class to exist. And so because of that, anti-racism has to be a part of, right? And I think racial capitalism is contesting that, like, it's not capitalism plus a little racial analysis or plus a little anti-racism, but that, like, race has to be fundamental to how we understand how classes are created and how capitalism exists. And I think that's really, really fundamental, because when it's just critiques of capitalism or just things that are described as like class struggles, sometimes we lose sight of that really necessary component of resistance and struggle against capitalism, which is the fight against racism.
Yeah, I think that that's a great point. And I think that in, like, to go to the foreword, Robin Kelly's foreword, which for anyone who has that third edition is a really great sort of background to a lot of Robinson's Robinson's own background to the book. And like, really, there's a lot of insights there because Robin Kelly knew Cedric Robinson personally. And he sort of talks about how racial capitalism, like the sort of the first time the sort of term concept came about was in South Africa in the 1970s. So in the fight against apartheid. So as Aurelius has sort of referenced already, like Robinson didn't like coin the term, but in South Africa, it was referring to like the specifically South African situation and the way that capitalism worked in South Africa, because, you know, as we've noted with the importance of struggles being connected to this work, they were sort of theorizing about how capitalism works in their own country in an effort to end apartheid and to do so in like a decisive manner. So to end apartheid, but not let, you know, economic inequality persist. Which, you know, as we've seen in the past 30 years, like it has persisted in South Africa, and you know, Robinson and Kelly would point out that part of that is because of the inability to destroy capitalism and racism. So Robinson takes racial capitalism, you know, as this specific thing referring to South Africa, and he turns it into like a general like theory for understanding capitalism as a whole. So he's saying that racism and capitalism are intertwined everywhere that capitalism is, not just in South Africa. And he's saying that capitalism expands through racism. So, you know, capitalism is a system that's dependent upon new markets, dependent upon, you know, more profit. And the way that, you know, people who are in power in that system, the way that capitalists sort of access those new markets, exploit those new markets, gain those new profits is by subjugating racialized populations or racializing new populations in order to subjugate them. And I think that that's important because it shows how racism is integral to economic exploitation. And it shows how racism is sort of, you know, when you racialize a group of people, it becomes easier to exploit them economically because now you can make the argument, you know, the racist argument would be, oh, well, these people are quote unquote lesser than some other group of people. Therefore, like, it's fine if we exploit them. Like, that's the general sort of line of thinking. Right. And that is really important to like his broader argument, because once he shows that capitalism is racialized, he's now able to say like, okay, you know, you thought that the, you know, according to Marxists, that it was like the English working class, the proletariat, who's like the main sort of resistance to capitalism. But since it's racialized, this opens up a whole new sort of discussion of who the main sort of group of people resisting the rise of capitalism are, because we now understand that it's intertwined with racism, especially, but not exclusively, against African people.
Which is a perfect segue to part three and the unpacking of these great Black intellectual activists throughout the 20th century, W.E.B. Du Bois, C.L.R. James, and Richard Wright. There are chapters dedicated to each of these intellectuals. We won't dive deep into each of them for time's sake, but maybe we can say just a little something about each of them and their contributions and sort of how Robinson is saying that they are clearly a part of this Black radical tradition. I would say, you know, for W.E.B. Du Bois, Robinson is specifically mainly looking at Black Reconstruction in America, which is, I think Katrina on every podcast has highly recommended it. Every reading group has highly recommended it. If you think Black Marxism is a doozy, Black Reconstruction is a doozy. It's like twice as long, I feel like. But what Du Bois is doing is he's going back in the archive, which is a, you know, archival methods are like a common methodology used by all historians, essentially. And Du Bois is essentially like saying like all of these white historians from the past who are looking at the histories of the United States and of chattel slavery and things of these natures missed so much, right? And he's essentially correcting the archive and correcting the record within Black Reconstruction. And Du Bois is also, and each of these people, but Du Bois specifically, is also like contesting with class analysis and Marxism and critiques of capitalism in a particular time period where racism and racialized violence is incredibly heightened in the United States, right? And so Du Bois is crucial to thinking about this Black radical tradition.
Yeah, I think that one part of like his discussions of Du Bois, James, and Wright that's interesting, and this is particularly true for Du Bois and James, a little more so than Wright, and especially, this is especially true for Du Bois, is that like Du Bois has the sort of benefits of being part of the Black middle class, like, you know, throughout most of his life. Like, he was born in Massachusetts, you know, he's trained formally as a historian. He also was in Europe for part of his, like, part of his education. C.L.R. James, you know, in contrast, is more of like an autodidact, like self-trained. Richard Wright as well. So it's interesting because, you know, there's a part of where he's talking about Du Bois, James, and Wright, especially Du Bois and James, where they're sort of like, they have access to these certain middle class things, you know, like certain levels of education, like knowledge of Western civilization. And like he sort of hints at or shows how like initially this sort of inhibited their ability to understand like Black radical tradition, because like they had sort of, you know, they had being Black middle class, you know, especially in the late 19th, early 20th century, makes you sort of like, one, the Black middle class is like usually buying into like the sort of like norms of like respectability politics, in ways that like the Black working class like is not. So like the Black middle class is more aspirational, and like to sort of realize their position as a middle class, like they have to buy into some of these like white norms. But in doing that, which I think Du Bois does more than the other two, like it's not a knock on him, it's just a product of his circumstance. In doing that, he's sort of early in his career, before he writes Black Reconstruction, I think that he like, you know, was not quite reaching the same conclusions about like Africa as the root of like Black resistance. But you see by the time like you get to the 1930s, he reaches those conclusions. So I think that's really interesting. And then I also think it's interesting that when Robinson wrote the book in 1983, like that's coming on the back of a period of time in the 70s where the Black middle class is expanding a lot, sort of like in the wake of the civil rights movement. You know, the people who benefited most from the civil rights movement in Black America were the, you know, upwardly mobile people who were like either in or almost in the Black middle class. So, you know, you see this sort of class, this growth in like class differences in Black America, like in the time that he writes the book. So, because you have the growth of the Black middle class, you have the rise of like neoconservatism and Reagan and mass incarceration, something we've talked about. And this is sort of shaping his thinking about class in the 1970s and 1980s. So I think in a way, his discussions of Du Bois in particular, or sort of making a commentary about how the Black middle class, you know, in the early 20th century when Du Bois was alive, but also when he was writing, like was having a hard time coming to terms with like who really is the source of like Black revolt. And it's not like, you know, people running for president, like, you know, it's like Black workers. So that's one thing. And then the other thing that I think is interesting, a little more about C.L.R. James, is that James, so he talks about Black Jacobins, Robinson does, we read that book by James earlier in the reading group, and then a book that James also wrote right around the same time is the history of at the time it was called A History of Negro Revolts, now called A History of Pan-African Revolt. And that book, he's talking about African resistance, and you can also see like the ways in which he's saying like, okay, it's these like African religious practices that are like the roots of Black resistance. So I think that's another thing that, you know, to tack on to our discussions of the Black Jacobins, is something that Robinson gets at that's important. It's like James is grappling with like African history as well in that moment.
That's great. Let's move to major takeaway from this book. I think we've gotten into some key things, key concepts and understandings, but just on a personal level, what are your main takeaways from the book?
So for me, the, you know, few main takeaways, there's like the main concepts that Robinson introduces. Racial capitalism is one, Black radical tradition is the other. Black radical tradition being this indigenous tradition of Black resistance that's rooted in like African ontology, epistemology, culture. Like that's one of the takeaways for me, is that he introduces these like relatively new concepts to us. And these are concepts that have become important to both like scholarly works on these topics since then, and also activism. Especially Black activism. And then the other takeaway for me is, which kind of gets at the core of his argument, Robinson's argument, which I take to be that that he's arguing through a critique of Marxism that there is this indigenous tradition of Black radicalism. And the sort of thing that I think we have to remember there is that he's saying that if Black people are going to be free, it has to be on their own terms. Like they can't expect to gain their freedom through like Marxism, you know, what you could also talk about other theories that are not capable of understanding their experience, you know, because it's a theory that is, you know, materialistic, rooted in Western assumptions. So he's saying that like mass struggles have to take place on the terms of the people struggling. So it has to take place like through their understanding of the world, and it has to be rooted in their culture, or else it's not going to succeed if it's not taking place on their terms.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. I love this stuff. For me, main takeaway One is, and I sort of mentioned it earlier, but that like organizing of today, Black radical organizing is a part of this tradition and this legacy of the Black radical tradition. And I think is what I love so much about this book because, yeah, it's you know, there's a romanticization of certain time periods and eras of Black resistance and struggles. You know, you often point back to the civil rights movement and things of that nature. And so I think there is something to looking forward and also why we are taking lessons from the past. And I think Robinson is also contesting and thinking about time periods and like temporalities, which I think is super interesting because he is like looking at these Black intellectuals from certain time periods, right? And he is looking at like 16th century theoretical frameworks, right? But he's also saying towards the end of the book that it's not always useful to look at things so structured and so far as time periods as something that happened in the 20th century being radically different than something that happened in the 18th century or the 21st century, right? So to also think about like radical temporalities, radical understandings around like how time works and how concepts, theories, and people exist like beyond the boundaries of time periods, I think is super fascinating. And he says, the point is that the construction of periods of time is only a sort of catchment for events. Their limited utility, though, is often abused when we turn from the ordering of things, that is chronological sequencings, to the order of things, that is the arrangement of their significances, meanings, and relations. Increments of time contoured to abstract measures rarely match the rhythms of human action. And I think that's just a beautiful sort of look into humankind and how we exist in relation to each other across time periods and how we learn from people who we've never met, how we learn from people who through their writings and through the actions that they've made throughout history across centuries is really profound in like, one, the importance of what we're doing here, which is studying, which is reading, which is understanding the works of Cedric Robinson and Du Bois and Richard Wright and C.L.R. James and others, and also how the work that we're doing in today is a part of this tradition and this legacy, and then making and remaking the world as we see fit. So I love it. And with that, we're going to take a break and come back with a micro game. And we are back for our micro game called Robinson Said. I will pass it to our game architect, Nate.
Howdy, everybody. So this game today, as Aurelius mentioned, is called Robinson Said, and that's said, C-E-D, short for Cedric. So just a fun little homophone note for anyone who's listening and didn't catch that little pun. It's in there. This game is going to work a lot like Simon Says, but the activation phrase will be Robinson Said. So we'll start the game now by giving each of you 10 points, and we are going to go through some fun exercises. Each time you do something that Robinson hasn't said, you will lose a point. Fail to do something that Robinson has said, and you'll lose a point. Last person standing wins the game. Can you each please confirm that you understand the rules?
I do understand. I believe so, at least.
Robinson didn't say.
Okay. That was sneaky.
Well, get ready. There's a lot more where that came from, and good work, Aurelius. Both of you. Robinson said, anytime you use a proper noun, clap twice. Aurelius. Robinson said, rap as much of the song Backstreet Freestyle by Kendrick Lamar as you can remember, replacing all of the non-family friendly words with other words.
All my life I want money and power. Respect my mind or die from lead shots. I pray my rose get big as the Eiffel Tower. But
Robinson said, unfortunately, you said Eiffel and you did not clap twice.
Shit.
you can continue.
Get big as the Eiffel Tower so I can screw the world for 17 hours.
All right, you can stop.
Yeah, I know it all, actually. I could have kept going.
Robinson didn't say.
I didn't say to stop. Sorry. Robinson said you can stop, though, now. So that's 2 points away from Aurelius. There's more where that came from, y'all. So just gear up. It's getting more
this
malicious.
This is hard. Because I'm trying to remember lyrics and think about what Robinson said.
Now, both of you, Robinson said, give a 5-second analysis of the portions of the song that were just used so we can use it under fair use on this podcast.
Backstreet Freestyle is an amazing song by Kendrick Lamar from his album Good Kid, M.A.A.D City.
But Robinson said,
Kendrick Lamar, that would be a proper noun.
Okay, Backstreet Freestyle offers an interesting commentary on money and power in the context of Kendrick Lamar's life.
That's an excellent analysis, y'all. I really appreciate it. So now that's fair use for our edit. Okay. Garrett. Robinson said, sing as much of Kokomo by the Beach Boys as you can remember, replacing the names of any tropical islands with Midwestern cities.
Oh God, how much do I remember? Like, this is that's a tough part.
And just as a fun little aside, heads up, there's also a Kokomo, Indiana. So as far as I'm concerned, you can leave that one.
So what if I don't, if I can't remember anything about the chorus, do I just do the chorus?
Let's hear it.
And I'm not even sure if this is right. It has Kokomo in it. I know that much.
But Robinson said,
Kokomo's a proper noun. Oh. Sorry.
Okay. Well, I don't really remember anything from the song, to be completely honest. Besides, it's just like Kokomo. Like, that's all I remember. Like, I don't remember anything else. So,
and
I got the clap in there, so.
Well, I guess you get off on a technicality with that one. You don't have to sing it for us, but that is the Bermuda, Bahama, you know, that one.
Okay, yeah, now it rings a bell.
Right now, you're each at 7 points, so hanging in there together.
All right.
Aurelius.
Mm-hmm.
Trip like a bird. Well done. Garrett. Robinson said chirp like a bird.
Chirp, chirp.
Well done. Aurelius, Robin said, convince me that you know what bird Garrett was chirping as.
Garrett was clearly chirping as an East African.
Sorry, you said Garrett's name. That's a proper noun.
I'm forgetting that first one a lot.
Go ahead.
He clearly was chirping as a hawk, native to Arizona, because they make that sound.
But Robinson said,
Garrett, tell me what bird you think you actually were impersonating. Garrett, Robinson said, tell me what bird you think you were actually impersonating.
An oriole.
Okay, we'll take it. I feel like hawk was, it was a very pretty deep intonation, so I'm going to let hawk slide. Let's see. Moving on to the next prompt. Both of you. Robinson said, turn off your video and find something to make an interesting noise. You have 30 seconds. All right. Your 30 seconds is up. You can each make your noise with your video off. Oop. Whose noise is that? Is that Garrett? Garrett, that's a point away from Garrett because Robinson didn't say.
Oh my gosh.
I'm locked in.
Okay. Robinson said, make your noise. Let's start with Garrett since he jumped the gun. All right. Now, Aurelius, Robinson said, make your noise. Interesting. Okay, with video off still, Robinson said, with video off still, Aurelius, Robinson said, identify what Garrett's noise was.
It sounded like a little camera that you click to like the neck, you know, like a...
Like winding film on like a disposable.
Exactly, yeah, okay. A disposable camera.
Now, Garrett, identify what Aurelius's noise was.
It Robinson sounded said, like...
Ooh, I think you started before Robinson said. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all right.
Robinson didn't say.
All right. Robinson said, identify what Aurelius's noise was.
Okay. I don't think this is correct, but it sounded kind of like if it was a book and you were just like flipping the pages really fast, sort of. But I'm pretty sure that's not right. So just had like a flapping noise to it. So that's my best guess.
All right. Now, will you each please turn on your video to reveal what your noise was to see if you were correct or not? And that is 1 point away from Garrett.
Oh, my gosh.
Robinson said, Aurelius, go ahead and turn on your video. All right. Hold up your objects, please. Oop. That's a point away from Aurelius and from Garrett.
This is not my object.
Oh, there you go.
I just have it in my hand.
All right. Robinson said, please hold up your objects. Okay, so no points away from Aurelius. That's one more point away from Garrett, though, because that is not a book. What is that, Aurelius?
It's a popper, like a fidgety thing.
Oh, that's looks like something I might need.
Yeah, we have a bunch at our office. They're nice.
Oh, that looks fun to play with.
Yeah.
Moving forward.
Well, you asked what it is, but you didn't say Robinson said. So, like, I guess Robinson asked. So, like, I guess.
Yeah, Robinson asked there. Sorry. That one wasn't a command. But I like it, though. Although, I will say.
But Robinson said.
You did say Robinson. No two claps. Okay, we are 1 point away from the end times, Garrett.
Yeah. At
right
this
now,
point, I'm trying to set a record. So,
right now, with the points being 5-1, we are in the danger zone. Aurelius, Robinson said, recreate Garrett's noise. Garrett will be the decider of whether or not you recreated the noise well enough to retain a point. All right, Garrett, decide whether or not he gets to keep that point. Robinson said.
I think it was close, but not quite close enough. I think it was less clicky, more like zippy. So
there you have it. Moving forward from that, now it's your turn, Garrett, to make Aurelius's noise. Robinson said, make Aurelius's noise to the best of your ability.
This is not going to be perfect, but...
All right, Aurelius, tell me what you think. Yes or no?
Nah. That's clearly a book, you know? Like, that clearly sounds like a book.
Ah! Sorry to say it, but... I will say, since... Aurelius is not letting you keep the points. That would be the natural end to our game. It would be 0-3 at this point. But I happen to carry around a bag of life extension points with me at all times.
Of course.
And I'm adding in 5 points into our game so we can keep it going just a little bit longer. So each of you are getting a bonus here, 5 extra points.
Okay.
And we're going to just keep pushing this thing and see where it goes. Robinson said... Anytime you use a number, immediately follow the number with a proper noun. So if I were going to say 7, I would say like 7 oranges or something. Not oranges, that's not proper. 7 Antonio Banderas's. Are both of you clear on the rules? Give me a thumbs up if you understand. Oh, nice. Robinson said, give me a thumbs up if you understand. Wonderful. Robinson said, Garrett, guess what number I am thinking of?
12 CLR Jameses.
But Robinson said.
Sorry, you didn't clap for the proper nouns. So that is one more point away from Garrett. I am thinking of a lower number, so go ahead and try again. Robinson said, try again. I saw him thinking. I think he was going to do it, but I'll be nice about this one.
6 Karl Marxes.
So that's closer, but still lower. So one more time for me. Robinson said, think of a lower number.
4 Aureliuses.
I love this song. Still a little lower. So one more time for me, if you would. Robinson said.
3 W.E.B. Du Boises.
It's not 3. It's still a little higher than 3. So could you go again for me? I didn't say a whole number, y'all. Robinson said go again. Sorry, I forgot on that one.
This is outrageous.
3.25 Walter Rodney's.
Oh, it's just barely lower than 3.25. I'll give you a hint. It has infinite sort of decimals. So, okay. So Robinson said, let me know what you think the number is now.
3.14 Angela Davis's.
I'll give it to you. It was pi. Pi was the number.
Yeah, I figured. Yeah.
Robinson said, Aurelius, solve this set of equations for X. You might want to get out a pen for this, by the way. Well, oh, you already have a pen.
Yep.
Hold on. Although,
Robinson didn't say.
So, what's the point away from Aurelius there?
Oh, my goodness.
Holding up that pen. Okay. Robinson said, Aurelius, solve this set of equations for X. 3X over 2Y equals 4.5Z, where Z equals pi over 4.5.
What the fuck, man?
And Y equals 0.5Z.
Z equals pi what?
Z equals pi over 4.5. And Y equals 0.5Z. And Robinson said, do your work out loud.
Okay. So I really hate this question or this command because I'm a social sciences guy. I'm a humanities guy. I like to write, you know, I like to think. I'm a qualitative guy. All right. I don't do numbers or math and shit. and this feels like algebra and I have trauma with algebra. So I don't appreciate this. Let's see. Let me try to figure this out. All right. So, I'm solving for X.
You're solving for X.
Okay. So, this is crazy to me. Y equals 0.5Z.
But Robinson said.
He did say 0.5 though. So
oh, a fucking number. Oh, this is going to be crazy. Can I skip? Can you just take a point away?
Yeah, we'll take that point away. That was the last question in our game, and it got pretty close in that bonus point hour. But with 5 points remaining compared to Garrett's 4 points remaining, Aurelius is today's winner. Woo! And that is what Robinson said.
Robinson said, fuck math.
Ooh.
But Robinson said,
that, I didn't get my claps there. It's okay. The game's over. Thanks for playing. And thanks for putting up with my torture once again. As always, this has been
Home Team.
The answer was pi squared over 13.5.
Yeah, so you really wanted me to do a whole fucking math equation.